You know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington. I'm a senior writer for Consequence of Sound and the founder and editor-in-chief of The Spool.
And my name is Nathan Rabin, and I am the entirety of Nathan Rabin's Happy Place and the co-host of this podcast that you're listening to and the author of a number of books.
Now, if you're joining us for the first time today, congratulations. And also, why are you starting here? But also, this is a podcast about in which we are tracking the many concerns and themes and strange coincidences that track Sir John Travolta and Sir Nicolas Cage's rapidly intersecting film careers. And this double feature in particular is very interesting, where we're talking about movies directed by people who would either later or earlier go on to direct the other actor in other movies. And of course, we're talking about 1999's The General's Daughter on the case of Travolta, and 2000's Gone in 60 Seconds, a film that it surprised me to realize was made a year before the first Fast and Furious. Which is very, very interesting. And we have a very wonderful guest here. I'm very, very excited to have him on, especially considering his links to the project that started all of this, screenwriter extraordinaire Simon Barrett. Simon, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find you doing it?
I'm a writer and director of usually small horror movies, but I am writing the Face Off sequel with my creative partner Adam Wingard on that film, which we are calling Face Off 2. So that is my Cage Travolta connection. It's not yet come to fruition, but hopefully it will.
Excellent, excellent. And you know, as we're recording this, your creative partner Adam Wingard is enjoying some very interesting success with Godzilla versus Kong. Sort of, how has that felt?
I mean, you know, I have nothing to do with Godzilla versus Kong, so.
Seeing your friend doing so well.
Well, obviously, I'm furious. Is what I was getting at. No, I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, you know, I saw Adam go through the process of making that movie. And, you know, over years and years, you know, he worked on that film. And you know, I'm so happy that, like, it was a film that audiences were able to actually see. I mean, I think for a while, he was really not certain if people were going to even have a chance to see it in theaters. And the fact that it's kind of being heralded as this film that's brought theaters back is obviously tremendously gratifying, and you know, might even help us get a Face-Off sequel made. Who knows?
So the rumor that you were actually the guy inside the King Kong costume the entire time, that was not you. That's just a rumor.
Not accurate. That's actually Macon Blair.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah, that tracks. He didn't even need a suit. He's just gotten gradually hairier as his career has gone on, and he ended up being King Kong. Yeah, I love it. Well, I can't wait to talk to you a little bit more about these particular two films and any sweet deets we can get from you from this, like, Face-Off sequel you're writing. But before we start that, I want to remind people that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. If you want to throw us a buck or two to help keep the lights on, we would very much appreciate that. We do monthly exclusive patron-only episodes. This month, we're going to try to get one done on Jiu-Jitsu, a movie I'm very interested in visiting. So we'll see what happens there, especially now that it's on Netflix, so I don't have to pay for it or pay any extra for it.
Ooh, Jiu-Jitsu's on Netflix?
Yeah, it is.
I haven't seen it yet. Okay.
I've
also noticed that Hulu, they're crushing it on the late period Nicolas Cage front. Like, either they know me very, very well, or they're just like, we've got a bunch of late period Nicolas Cage movies. You're going to love it.
There's so many Hulu that I still need to catch. Yeah.
Yeah. Hulu is kind of the new red box for people who don't go outside anymore. And we shouldn't be going outside, but especially that. Yeah. So, without further ado, let's get started with The General's Daughter.
From the producer of Clear and Present Danger.
Oh, no. The General's Daughter.
Do you have any suspects?
Everyone.
Before you arrest anyone, you notify me.
And the director of Con Air.
You're going to have to decide on this one. Are you a soldier or a policeman.
Why was she murdered?
Profit, revenge, jealousy, to conceal a crime, or plain old homicidal mania.
Were you aware of Elizabeth's extracurricular activities?
It was kept confidential.
What, she violated a code? She cheated? She lied? What?
Worse. Oh, my God.
You'll ruin it all.
Rape.
Worse.
What's worse than rape?
When you find that out, then you'll know everything, won't you?
John Travolta.
Nothing is gained by my involvement.
Madeline Stowe.
You'd better start thinking about your career.
And you better start thinking about yours.
The General's Daughter.
Now, Simon, I know you have a little bit more to say about The General's Daughter, so I'll throw this to you. Would you mind recapping for the listeners the basic premise of The General's Daughter?
Whew, okay. I want to say the reason I chose this double feature to speak with you both about was because these were two films that I'd seen but had completely eradicated from my memory. I saw them both around the time they came out, as I tend to do, and I just didn't have any recollection of them. Other than that, I kind of found them both, you know, vaguely disappointing. So I was absolutely able to rediscover the narratives of both films on my subsequent reviewing for this podcast, which I did while Adam and I were working on a script, so I just barely was paying attention, which I thought was
better. It's apropos.
The General's Daughter. Okay, here's my interpretation of the plot of The General's Daughter. And you just tell me what I get right and wrong. And I don't know how much we go into spoilers. The General's Daughter is a very hard film to talk about because for me, everything about it kind of works except the mystery itself and the plot itself and having a director who's really at odds with his material. But aside from those things, it feels like a film where its heart is basically in the right place and it's kind of well shot and it's kind of well acted. And it stars John Travolta as a, I'm just going to say, I don't think he is, but I'm going to say a military police sergeant. But I don't think he is. I think he works at like an armory and is in charge of the armory or something. And that's why in the opening scene, he's going undercover as like an illegal arms seller. And he does a more exaggerated Southern accent for that scene like, to confuse you from the other one he's doing occasionally. Yeah. And he, on his way home from one of his action adventures, he has a flat tire, and a young female army officer helps him. And then the next day, he's called to a like murder scene where she's been found dead. For some reason, Madeline Stowe is there, with whom he has a past relationship. Maybe because she actually represents law enforcement. I'm not actually clear on that. He has a past relationship with her, of course. Where she was cheating on her husband with him, I believe, is the backstory there. And they investigate this murder of this woman who's this army officer, female army officer, has been found naked, bound to stakes out in the open with like weird inconsistent things about the murder scene, you know, involving her ligatures and such. But essentially it's being investigated as a rape homicide. And this is kind of the sort of movie that now is just a TV show. You know, it's a film for adults. It's somewhat like salacious. It's R-rated, and you know, it's we don't really make these anymore, which is I think the thing that I found most intriguing about it. But that's the basic gist of the narrative.
Yeah, it's very classic, like airport thriller kind of sex crimes kind of thing. And like you said, I think in the 90s it would have been an episode of a show. Now it would be like an 8-episode limited series where they're solving the murder.
Yeah, it would be like you know, military police SVU or whatever.
Right.
You know, and so yeah, so that's the basic narrative, all of which is fairly interesting because it deals, of course, with the quite serious topic of sexual assault in our military, particularly in military training facilities, which has been in the news lately. So on one hand, you know, like this movie is kind of way ahead of like documentaries like The Invisible War by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, I think, is the co-director on that. And, you know, other films of that nature, you know, that kind of exposed the fact that this is a real problem. You know, it is a little ahead of its time in that regard, but it is so convoluted in what actually happened to its murder victim and, you know, goes so out of its way to kind of find ways. You know, she's obviously not culpable for what's happened to her in the past, but she's definitely culpable for what kind of happens to her that leads to her ultimate death. At least she's very involved in this orchestration, the film reveals, which to me certainly complicates its message, as well as, of course, its theme that all these people are caught and punished in like totally, you know, the system totally works, just maybe like a little late, you know.
For sure.
So there's that, there's that aspect as well, which, you know, which kind of, again, slightly seems to mar or dilute the film's good intentions. But it's an interesting movie. It was better than I remembered.
Yeah, I guess so. It's very competently made. And to touch on your point, I do want to point out for the podcast, just as grain of salt for anything we talk about with this, this is a podcast featuring three men talking about this. So like absolute grain of salt. But yeah, I tend to agree where it is like, it feels like its heart is in the right place where it is. It's using this case of a raped and murdered female officer to sort of uncover and unearth this wider rape culture in the military and this history of sexual assault and the pervasiveness of it. But the way they characterize the victim herself leads her to make all these decisions that don't paint her in a very favorable light. And it gets kind of borderline slut-shamey and sort of accuses her of having this like mental illness. And it becomes very, very complicated. And it feels like it has to do that in order to reverse engineer the incredible extreme situation that is the setup, where you find her naked and gagged and like spread eagle and strangled. And you have to work your way backwards from there. And to find the most like dramatic way of doing it revolves this slightly problematic, you know, involvement and culpability on her part that feels, again, like counterintuitive, like you said.
I totally kind of have vague memories of this as being unpleasant and distasteful. And yeah, I think kind of going back, like, yeah, this definitely is not dealing with sexual assault, the after effects, the repercussions of sexual assault in a terribly tasteful or overly sensitive kind of way. And I kind of feel like part of the danger that you have there is you establish the titular character, the general's daughter, as like this very impressive woman. Like, she's very smart, she's very capable, she has a sort of fire about her. And then she dies, and then she is completely reduced to her sexuality and her sexual history and her trauma and her daddy issues. You know, there's just kind of this psychology that's employed that is very, very kind of cheap. You know, and again, I wish that this had been made later. I feel like 1999 was way too early for this. And I think, again, it's an interesting movie to look at in 2021 because the element of women in the military seems like such a novelty in this movie.
Yeah, this came out around the same time as movies like Courage Under Fire and G.I. Jane, where this was made, there was a meal was made of this.
Yeah, it was written in 1992. And honestly, like, I wish this entire movie had been John Travolta with a ridiculously over-the-top Southern accent, like a Boss Hog Southern accent, living on a houseboat, pretending to be a detective in the South. I'm like, I want to see this cheesy-ass CBS detective show from the 1980s. I don't want to see this like weird, you know, sort of psychologically fraught, very sort of insensitive sort of exploration of sexual assault.
Yeah, this movie is directed by Simon West, who we should point out directed Nicolas Cage in Con Air just a few episodes back. And yeah, I love that Simon West seems
to he brings the sensitivity you would imagine the Con Air guy bring to a story like this.
But I love that thanks to Simon West, we now have movies where both John Travolta and Nicolas Cage have horrible Southern accents. And for him, I should be forever thankful.
You know, when I say that The General's Daughter is kind of a film at odds with its material, Simon West's direction is kind of what I'm thinking of specifically, whereas you can tell that he doesn't know whether to make this a salacious movie, a very dark and upsetting or disturbing film, which would more suit its topic, and he just wants to make it a fun action movie. You can tell desperately. So, like, there's all these crazy kind of, like, over-the-top, amazingly shot, very expensive-looking action scenes in the film. That really, many of them have nothing whatsoever to kind of do with the plot. They're kind of sandwiched in, but they look gorgeous. And, you know, I think what we're responding to is something that probably did feel progressive at the time, which was showing the horrors of sexual assault and how much effect it had on someone. But now, from a 2021 perspective, we're all kind of like, well, this film portrays rape as a life-defining and essentially life-ending act. You know, something that cannot be recovered from, that changes who you are as a person. And that's like a very negative thing. You know, like I've seen criticisms of the recent release Promising Young Woman for that exact reason. From like, I guess I would say kind of feminist film scholars approaching it from a different perspective. And certainly like this movie gets that kind of, I guess, most egregiously wrong, and that you really, like Nathan was saying, only know this character through that. But it's also, it just feels tonally odd. Mm-hmm. It's telling such a dark narrative that's kind of so cynical about human nature, but it's doing it in kind of a way that indicates that it's trying to be just like a fun pulpy thriller sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I just think like, I just think it really is like Simon West was not certain whether he wanted to make a very serious film about a very serious issue, or a movie where John Travolta is like shooting people while leaping through a swamp. And he tried to make both. And the overall effect is, I agree. The first time I saw this, I remember thinking like, that movie was like somehow unsavory and kind of unpleasant.
I need to take a shower now.
Yeah, rewatching, I was like, you know, but considering like, you know, the films that I watch, I tend to watch a lot of exploitation movies, you know, a Serbian film, I Spit on Your Grave. Like those films somehow didn't bother me as much as The General's Daughter when I first saw it. And I kind of do understand why, even though, again, watching it now, it's kind of like, well, this movie is made in a way that movies just aren't made anymore. It's an R-rated film for adults dealing with serious subject matter. It looks great. It clearly cost a fortune, and it made a fortune. It was a big success, despite critics largely hating it. I thought it was a flop because I remember the response being kind of negative. But I looked it up, and it was a big hit, financially at least. So it kind of does make me nostalgic for an era where like our blockbusters were these like R-rated adult thrillers, which it seems unlikely that we'll ever really get again, unless David Fincher is doing it.
Well, and I feel like this kind of came out at a time sort of like G.I. Jane, where the idea was any movie with a woman in the military is by definition a referendum on women in the military. Mm-hmm. And this, again, has a very complicated, messy, like, again, you're sort of saying, sort of it's working against itself, like, what is this movie trying to say? Or is it just trying to be lurid and sensationalistic and, you know, entertaining with, you know, this, again, this kind of all of these problematic aspects, I guess, would be kind of a good way. But it's, now you have, you know, William Goldman, one of the greatest screenwriters in history, is one of the screenwriters here. And there's a lot of punchy, fun dialogue that's maybe a little too punchy and maybe a little too fun and maybe a little too much like, it's nice that, you know, James Woods and John Travolta are like getting stuff to do. But it also, again, kind of detracts from the darkness and the seriousness of the subject matter, which is unbelievably grim and, again, not handled in a terribly sensitive or tasteful fashion.
Yeah. Speaking of James Woods, I appreciate that even all the way back in 1999 and even earlier, filmmakers knew that they could use James Woods to kind of squeak you out and make you really suspicious because you knew how innately a weird dude he is. But yeah,
it's too bad he's such a jerk, because I do enjoy him this thoroughly in almost every film he's in. Yeah. And obviously this was kind of a great era for him, especially. And, you know, it's interesting. It's a good script, but it has what I kind of think of like trailer lines that don't really make sense in the film itself. Mm, I remember in particular, and I just remember this from being young and in the theaters, the General's Daughter trailer kind of had this big moment where they're like, where Travolta's like, is it murder? And they're like, worse. He's like, rape, like, worse. He's like, what's worse than rape? And that was like the big trailer stinger moment. And it's also like totally a cheat, because it is actually, in fact, rape and murder is in fact the crime. And like, I don't know what is worse than that, but the movie doesn't answer that question. Like, I guess the answer is it's a combination thereof that's extremely complicated. When the film ultimately reveals what happened to its victim, which, again, I don't know if we want to spoil it, but it is kind of crucial to, like, just how complicated the answer of who killed her and why is so confusing that I wouldn't even know how to start explaining it. But I do understand it a little better now. I actually misremember this movie. I misremembered who the killer was.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting because watching this and seeing the cast list and B, seeing the character in question, as soon as he walks on screen, I'm like, oh, he totally did it.
I remembered as soon as I saw him was the funny thing. But like prior to it, I because of the title, I kind of remember, I don't want to spoil anything. If we're doing a no spoilers.
Honestly, you know, Simon, it's totally okay. We go through this movie's like 20 plus years old. We can 100% spoil it.
I misremembered it as the general killing his daughter. And that's not the case. He just did not help her when she was assaulted. And therefore is like responsible for that in a non-legal like fashion.
Yeah, it's complicated and convoluted in that there is a direct murderer, but they're all the sort of list of suspects are culpable in some way, whether it's whether it's, you know, the general himself, you know, being so complicit in covering up everything, and Clarence Williams III sort of being his enforcer, trying to keep these military secrets, and even to James Woods, you know, like in certain respects, feeling responsible, even though we sort of learn after the fact that he is not, in a very harrowing death scene featuring a cat that was probably the most tense I felt. I felt so bad for that poor cat. But yeah, it's very, very interesting to sort of weigh that.
Well, you sort of talked about sort of the way that it's shot. Like, for example, the rape scene I thought was shot. Like, is this a Zack Snyder movie or something? There was like a hallelujah chorus, and like everything was shot for just like maximum visceral impact. And it kind of
but without any clear intentions. Exactly. Like it's maximum impact on an individual shot basis, but not really thinking about like what's the overall effect of this scene or how does this feel in this film. That feels really confusing.
Yeah, it's also this vague sense that you're supposed to be kind of turned on by the idea of like she's the general's daughter and she's screwing everybody.
Yeah, it was that element to her character that felt really, really icky. The idea that
the way that people see it too is just like she was banging everybody, and not only that, but like she was having sex with everybody as a fuck you to her dad,
except for the person who killed her, because he's motivated by that sort of, I guess, that being such a beta cuck in the parlance of our times, where he just felt so cucked by it that he was motivated to murder. He was the nice guy who was waiting in the friend zone while she was, you know, taking, I guess, implicitly taking out this residual trauma from her sexual assault out on the base. And it's just so like tawdry, and like it really feels like it does a disservice to the women it's trying to represent.
Well, and I think what you're responding to is, again, kind of what I was saying earlier, which is that all of her actions are defined in response to men. Yeah, decisions that men have made. Because I mean, I think, oddly, again, I think there's a version of this film where its heart is completely in the right place. Like, you know, her becoming more sexually empowered as a response to what happened to her, you know, I think like could have been handled really responsibly. But again, the fact that she's never really shown to have any agency or be taking any like sort of pleasure in these actions, to me, is the kind of like subtle distinction that like really you wouldn't necessarily flag it at the time. But it's what kind of makes you walk away being kind of like, what was that saying? I mean, it's clearly saying that, like, you know, obviously assault is bad and the military is an institution, you know, a hierarchical, violent institution and patriarchal and misogynistic institution that leads, you know, directly to it. Sure. But it also like solves the problem completely by bringing in John Travolta. And, you know, it doesn't really feel like it's a pointed critique of any of our institutions for certain. Mm-hmm. It feels like it is a bad apples kind of case.
Oh,
and her response to it, you know, is honestly so complicated, you know, that it doesn't really feel like there's any real lessons the film is here to teach you. It you know, but look, at the same time, I saw obviously that Richard Rush passed away recently, and I was thinking about The Color of Night and just what a miracle The Color of Night is as a motion picture, and just how strange it is that we don't get like sleazy R-rated movies anymore, even though people clearly enjoy them and clearly like them and clearly want movies where like people just look good and sexy. And you know, I kind of do wonder if that is going to make, you know, a comeback, since our culture kind of goes in cycles. And reflecting on a film like The General's Daughter in a time when it would be not just like widely released, but like, you know, there was no cultural critique of this film that I remember. No one was having the kind of conversations about it that, I mean, I'm sure people were as they were leaving the theater. I'm certainly sure a lot of women were having probably much more insightful conversations than the one we're having. But the point is, this is a podcast and you're enjoying it.
Right, exactly. I can't help but wonder, you know, and this is obviously, you know, Travolta brings us into this movie by virtue of him starring in it. But I do wonder what kind of film it would have been had the protagonist been Madeline Stowe's character.
Yeah, which would have made a lot of sense, since she seems to like know what she's doing.
Yeah, she's a rape investigator. She knows about this stuff, but maybe doesn't have direct experience, or maybe does have direct experience with like the rape culture in the military and seeing this culture through her eyes, as opposed to this audience insert super badass army investigator who's like also a perfect undercover agent with a flawless Southern accent. And you can also kick ass.
Flawless. And this is really like this is also one of those like What Happened to Madeline Stowe kind of movies where, she's consistently good in everything. I was randomly just rewatching China Moon the other day, which was not as good as I remembered, but nonetheless is a unique and kind of wonderful film. And you know, she's the kind of actor that I really miss from these movies. And you know, I think she just kind of retired when I guess she aged out of the love interest roles for characters like John Travolta's protagonist. And it is true that it would be a much better and more interesting, and certainly a film that would have aged better. If she were our focus and our kind of entry point as viewers into the story, certainly I think it'd be a more relatable movie. Yeah,
I actually had the same question when I was watching this, because I was like, what did happen to Madeline Stowe? And so I looked it up. She is still working consistently. It's just more in TV. She was on Revenge as recently as a few years ago. And
that's crazy.
She's doing stuff. And,
She's a TV show called Reigns, talking about weird coincidences. Jeff Goldblum, 7-episode TV show called Reigns. Wow. Not based on Nicolas Cage's character from Gone in 60 Seconds, I'm guessing.
Yes.
I didn't even make that connection until now. I did look into her career as well and had the same reaction. I believe also she's been writing lately. I read that somewhere. That she started doing kind of screenwriting stuff for her own project. So good for her. Because
she's great in this. One of the major problems is the script doesn't give her enough to do. But when she does get command of a scene, like when she's dressing down the member of that fire team who was there the night of the general's daughter's initial rape. Like it's really powerful stuff. It's that kind of like Columbo-esque, and just one more thing kind of play that I think she does really well.
Well, and I'm also just, again, I would like to think that this movie would be different if it were made now, in part because hopefully now you can have an attractive man and an attractive woman and not have them either have sex or have them be former lovers. And I felt like just having that energy in here just made everything very stock. And very much, again, people can have relationships that are not sexual, even if they're men and women in movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You know, the weird coincidence that they had to be like past lovers, feels especially contrived in a film of this nature. Obviously, it's something that movies do all the time, like Jurassic Park being, I think, probably the kind of go-to. But yeah.
But it's like a lazy way to build rapport without having to like show it.
It's an easy way to create a romance. It feels like an easy way, but it actually always, I feel like, lands false with the audience. They're like, oh, what's the easiest way to have these characters connect romantically? Well, rather than show any genuine connection between them, which was difficult and would take like narrative real estate, I'll just have them be like exes who should have stayed together, but were driven apart for reasons. But of course, in real life, everyone knows that getting back together with your ex is a terrible idea. 99% of the time. Don't get mad at me. I'm sure it works out sometimes. But like 99% of the time, your parents are not going to get back together, and they probably shouldn't. And I say this as the child of multiply divorced parents, not with each other, but they only did it once with each other. But, but it's like, I would watch those movies and be like, it's not going to work out. Even as a kid, but as a screenwriter, you're like, well, here's a way to have sparks fly. What if they were having sex and they'd like to start again, but they just haven't been in the same place until now? Mm-hmm. And then there's your romance. There's your sexy scenes. Right. So, which of course, the general's daughter, you would just look at that premise and be like, this needs more of that. But I always hate it. I always hate it in movies when the characters have like past relationships that the audience is informed of. Really good actors can make that work with their chemistry. Madeline Stowe and John Travolta, it just doesn't feel like the right movie for them, to be honest. And
John Travolta, and this is not a terrible shocker, but apparently John Travolta wanted Kelly Preston for this role, and that would have added an interesting element to those scenes if you had obviously somebody who are famous for being together. Be people who are no longer together.
Sure. Right.
Are there more than two women in there than just Madeline Stowe and the titular general's daughter?
Well, there are a few like day player background, like female officers. Like there's that one, like night watch woman who like is giving them the timeline. And she's fun. She has a fun like single scene, but I don't think there's many apart from that.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's a total sausage fest. And again, I wish that it was a much sharper critique of military culture. I wish that it was a much sharper critique of rape culture. I wish that it was less sensationalistic and voyeuristic and exhibitionist and being like, this is gross and disgusting, but it's also kind of hot.
Right, right.
All those things that we wish this movie actually did are probably like what, like the fact that it did not do them are probably exactly what made it a huge box office success.
Okay. Or got it made in the first place.
1999, you know, I mean, that's, yeah, of course. I mean, it's just, it's a film that is really kind of, I think, like you said, trying to be kind of like an airport thriller.
Yeah, like I would like a Kimberly Pierce version of the story. But yeah, that kind of person was not getting the $100 million budget. And I also kind of appreciated that Nicolas Cage and John Travolta were both at the stage in their career where they could just have lots of helicopters. So if you ever need a helicopter, we have $75 million.
Helicopter shots of multiple helicopters just sailing along. We're just doing it for some reason. Looks great. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like Carter Burwell has a score just like blazing through. You know, we were talking a little bit about like, so you mentioned that there were lines that stuck out to you. Were there any that like that you can remember right now?
Oh, I mean, just the one that I quoted, just that like trailer stinger. I mean, I admit I watched this film, I'm going to say in like 2000 on probably DVD. And I watched it again yesterday while paying almost no attention to it. And I really only just wanted to figure out who murdered her. Because as soon, you know, or I knew who murdered her. I just was trying to remember how and why. And and because it's so convoluted and strange, the actual answers to those questions, which involve her essentially recreating an old assault solely for her father's viewing displeasure, is one of the places where that starts. And so, you know, so I didn't quite remember all those details and I didn't pay any attention to the film other than that. I was just like, what's going on here? Oh, that's right. She recreates it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. One phrase that stuck in my mind was when they're talking about sex. And again, the men in here, they talk about sex in a very gross way that is unfortunately realistic. And they refer to it as a piece of patch.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that is realistic. Because I've never heard that before in my entire life.
Well, it was, Madeline was like, okay, that's an incredibly gross way to refer to anything. But again, I feel like that phrase cannot exist in a movie that handles subject matter like this. Loaded subject matter, tricky subject matter, fraught subject matter, in a way that, doesn't make you just feel kind of icky.
You're right. It's like you have to take this subject. If I would never write a film with this kind of subject matter, is A, I don't feel like I have anything intelligent or responsible to say about it. And it's so inherently upsetting to people that if you don't have something to say, you really should not be commenting on it because everyone has some experience with it. Everyone's lives have been touched by it. You know, it's just there's certain subjects that, you know, like unless you have a way to kind of say something about them responsibly, I think you're better off not addressing them because they're not inherently entertaining. If you're entertaining people, you can kind of get away with anything. But if you're upsetting them, you kind of need to have a reason for it. And I think that's what we're responding to is like if you're going to do this, you have some kind of responsibility to the subject matter to at least portray certain elements of it, like semi-realistically. And that's, you know, and that's, I think, why that dialogue kind of stands out because it feels like weird studio note dialogue. I mean, my main issue with this movie is just sheerly as a murder mystery. Mm. Like this movie does so many like cheats to make its murder mystery feel more complicated and more like have more twists than it normally would. Like the elaborate circumstances of her death are essentially like could not be more complicated and more intentionally designed to lead to a complicated murder investigation than if that was her specific goal. She was like, I'm going to commit suicide and I'm going to do it in a way that leads to an incredibly elaborate murder investigation that results in the capture of all my attackers and anyone who's wrong with me. That would actually be at least, I would still be like, well, this is kind of a negative way to approach it. It's not, you know, necessarily inherently positive, but it's at least like somewhat of an interesting revenge story from that perspective. But instead, the movie just cheats and it's like, well, she did this weird thing for no good reason that confused that issue. And that's my real issue with it. It really gives itself what feels like a complicated murder mystery with a lot of twists and reveals, but it's just because whenever they wanted a twist and reveal, they were just like, well, maybe our crazy female victim did this.
Yeah, they really wanted to have a bunch of red herrings to keep the audience guessing, and they had to go through so many weird hoops to get to it. Yeah, and in terms of dialogue, the only other things I can really remember are just like all the faux badass lines they give John Travolta's character, like even just sort of his ironic sensitivity, like his ironic feminine side when he talks about bath beads. The Southern accent is like, no, really, I just dig bath beads. Golly dang, if you like pina coladas and getting caught in the ring, I may just have to marry you, Captain. Like, man, either that stuff needed to not be in the movie or that needed to be the movie.
Yeah, I preferred the glib first 20 minutes of it to the...
with the machine gun fights on a houseboat, yeah.
Absolutely. This movie starts like a crazy action movie, and like, I mean, at least people still know what pina coladas are, whereas bath beads are just these like weird things that we like, yeah, greasy things that we put in our bathtubs for a weird period, and that were just kind of like tactile, like pleasant in a tactile way, but not a good product. Yeah. Do people know what bath beads are now? Do kids know? Yeah, we moved on to bath bombs that are like equally weird. But yeah, I mean, do kids know what like bath beads are? I wouldn't put that in a script, because I would just assume no one knows what I'm talking about. But maybe that's still a thing.
Also,
yeah.
Have you guys ever known anybody who lived on a houseboat? I feel like those are things in television and film that don't actually exist in real life.
No, I've never known anyone. I wrote a Frankenfish. I wrote a sci-fi movie back in 2003 that I think aired in 2004 that took place in a houseboat community. I just completely made that up.
I want to see the Nomad Land for the houseboat community. That's what I want to see.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Well, it's good, but it's getting in a Twitter fight. But
I saw the writer. I like the writer.
Yeah, the writer's great. The writer's my favorite movie that year. But enough about good movies. Let's move on to Gone in 60 Seconds.
Time it took them.
Oh, let's go.
To steal your car.
Hello, ladies.
60 seconds. 60 seconds.
Move, go.
Come on, sweet baby, work your magic. Hold on, I know you ain't gonna do what I think you're gonna do.
Have to go old school. A day to shop, a day to prep.
Surprise attack.
Nice.
Little trick I learned of the car thief retirement home.
By the time the first car is reported stolen,
all this,
your ship set sail. We do this, we do it my way.
I was a sucker for a redhead.
Friend. Okay, let's run.
Gone. 60 seconds.
What do you think is more exciting, having sex or stealing cars?
Now, Nathan, break down for me the complicated, labyrinthine story of Gone in 60 Seconds.
Given
that we haven't seen the first 59 seconds movies.
Sure, this was a remake of a 1970s movie called Gone in 60 Seconds. And if I remember correctly, it was made by a used car salesman. And really? the big selling line was that like 30 cars got smashed in it. So Jerry Bruckheimer is like, if I had $100 million, I could crack up like 200, 300 cars. So, okay, so the premise of this motion picture is that
Nicolas Cage, it was 93 cars.
Yes, Nicolas Cage is Memphis Reigns, and he is the coolest guy in the world, and he is also the world's greatest car thief, but he's also the world's best guy. So he decides to get out of the car thievery game for the sake of his knucklehead younger brother, who is played by Giovanni Ribisi. And I have this weird relationship with Giovanni Ribisi where I realize realize that he is a very successful actor. I realize he's been in lots of movies. He was the bad guy in the second top grossing movie of all time. But I have this weird, like, why would anybody care about any character Giovanni Ribisi ever played? So Giovanni Ribisi gets into trouble being a fuck up. So Memphis Reigns, in order to get his brother out of trouble and get $200,000, which seems like a shockingly small amount of money, has to steal 50 high-end automobiles, the best cars in the entire world, the sexiest cars in the entire world. One of the fun things about this movie is it's about men who love cars so much, they kind of want to put their penises inside them. Throughout this entire film, I felt like we were like getting into Crash territory where they call them girls' names and they talk about them. If there are these,
the camera lingers on their curves and chassis.
Oh, for sure. And again, there's just so many wonderfully stupid elements of this. Scott Rosenberg, who wrote the one of the credited screenwriters of Con Air, for example, he made the main bad guy, Coletti, I believe he is. He's got a very Italian name.
Coletri.
Yes, Coletri.
AKA the Carpenter.
He has a very Italian name. And his thing is that he's into woodworking. And he's into woodworking so that he can show Nicolas Cage's character the casket that he built for Giovanni Ribisi in case he needs to kill him. And I'm like, how many hours must he have worked on that casket? It seems like such a giant waste to, you know, use it somewhere where nobody would know about it. So basically, so what happens is they have to steal 50 cars. So Nicolas Cage's character, Memphis Reigns, he needs to get back together his crew. And his crew involves people like Robert Duvall, who we saw last episode in A Civil Action. He's not quite as transcendent, although he does his usual fine work here. We have third Academy Award winner Angelina Jolie. For some reason, I thought she was like 20 years younger than Nicolas Cage. She's only about 11, 12 years younger. But of course, they never acknowledge that there's any age difference whatsoever between this.
Nor do they acknowledge those white dreads.
No. Which is a look. Oh my goodness, that's crazy. You have the Sphinx, which is a character that Vinnie Jones plays. He never talks, which is, I think, an improvement. A wonderful, wonderful idea. You have a character named Mirror Man, who has like this sort of off-brand Kevin Hart thing going on where he's wacky and wisecracking. And then that crew isn't enough, so they put together a second crew, which is Giovanni Ribisi's crew, and Scott Conn is part of the crew. So basically the first hour of this movie is this incredibly silly setup for the second hour, which is basically nothing but stealing cars in incredibly silly, stupid ways. There's a scene in the third act in which characters named Mirror Man and the Sphinx try to steal a car that has a cobra in the back seat to the accompaniment of DMX's Party Up. So the first time that I saw this movie, I was disappointed. I thought it was very stupid. I thought it was very cheesy. I thought it was very very Bruckheimer-y. And then this time around, I loved everything that I found stupid and insulting and ridiculous. Even stuff like, I remember when I saw it, when Master P showed up. I was like, oh, Master P, he's not a good actor. He's not a good rapper. He's just like the flavor of the moment. Like, can't believe, you know, like Jerry Bruckheimer, he's just pandering to the kids. And this time around, I'm like, fucking A, Master P. I love that. And again, I don't love that guy, but I think he's fascinating as a cultural figure and fascinating as a figure of kitsch. And I feel like that's what this was as well. It's fascinating as a figure. You also have just insanely loaded cast. The antagonists, other than Master P, of course, who's part of a rival crew, the good guys, sort of, are played by Delroy Lindo,
who should be nominated for an Oscar right now.
Oh my God, he's fantastic. And he's in so many of these movies, and he's so great. And then his partner is Timothy Oliphant. And I'm very, very young Timothy Oliphant. There are so many like silly moments that I loved about this, like one of which was Timothy Oliphant and Delroy Lindo kind of doing like a good cop, bad cop sort of routine, I think with Nicolas Cage. And Timothy Oliphant is like, oh yeah, yeah, you don't want to mess with him, you know, he's as mean as his wife is. And Delroy Lindo shoots him a very, very Delroy Lindo look of, you did not just fucking say that. You had better apologize to me immediately. We do not have a relationship in which you can ever say anything negative about my wife. So yeah, having like a 23-year-old, 24-year-old Timothy Oliphant in that role made it a whole lot better. And again, I think we talked about it before, that having $100 million to hire the best actors in the world and a helicopter for every single scene is not a recipe for great art. But for me, at least, it was a recipe for great entertainment. So what did you, I got the sense that I probably enjoyed this film substantially more than either of you did.
I think it's okay. It's one of those weird things where, again, like it came out a year before Fast and Furious. It feels, it's funny because I feel like in a lot of ways, both movies we're talking about today are in some ways knockoffs of Michael Bay visually. There's The General's Daughter, which is directed by Simon West, who directs a lot like kind of a dollar store Michael Bay, especially with Con Air, deliberately so. So The General's Daughter kind of feels like a mismatched genre mashup of The Rock's look. And here, Gone in 60 Seconds, is Michael Bay in Bad Boys 2 mode. So it's all very like slick and like neon coated and just drenched in a Trevor Rabin electronica score that is just like overbearing. And I mean, you know, we've talked about both movies having this. It is kind of an essential entry in what I like to call the dipshit canon, where it is just a movie about guys being dudes. And there's like the couple of with it chicks who will go, sort of on board with them. And that's Angelina Jolie. And it's one of those movies that is definitely trying for that sort of just dumb spectacle. But one of the major problems I have with it is that I feel like the car action isn't that great. There's one decent car chase, maybe. But other than that, like there's not a lot there. Not that I need it. Not that I need a lot of there, but especially once the heist gets going, this extended 50 car in one night heist, it becomes this episodic series of like farcical scenarios that have varying levels of entertainment value, especially given the sprawling cast we're asked to follow.
Oh, I agree. I think one thing that the Fast and Furious films got right that this movie didn't is just simply they had car chases. They're very similar. It's interesting. You absolutely do see the DNA, particularly for the Fast and Furious sequels in this movie, where they're just like, we need a guy who's good at talking. And then Ludacris shows up and you're like, okay, I buy that, whatever. I'm glad he's back. I'm glad he's here.
Excuse me, Tyrese is the guy who's good at talking. Ludacris is the tech expert.
Shit. That's right. Tyrese is the one that they like really can't justify. That's right. Actually, you know, the reason I got that confused is because Ludacris seems much better at talking.
Definitely. Yeah. He is much better at talking. He's one of the greatest rappers in the world, and he's incredibly funny, and they have Tyrese do all the funny talking things. But again, I think one of the trademarks of Jerry Bruckheimer movies is there's just random racism. They're just like, we're throwing in this offensive racism. So you have Chi McBride. Desmond
I knew you were going to talk about this scene.
Great, great, great character actor. The fact that he survived being a Desmond Pfeiffer. So he is a driving instructor, and for no goddamn reason at all, other than to be racist, there's a scene of him with an Asian woman, and she's driver, and she's driving very poorly. And it's so painful. And he's like, I can't swim. You're not going to see me going into a swimming pool because I'm a black man and I can't swim. It's like, please, like you do not have to be more racist. You can press the less racist button. You don't always have to go into
turn
that.
The dial down a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. But one of the reasons I think I like this, I feel like this has what other Bruckheimer movies lack, which is a core. And that core is Nicolas Cage. And I feel like there's this kind of sincerity that he brings to everything that he does, even if it's something as silly as, I really fucking love cars. And I feel like that kind of gives it an emotional core that you don't have in, say, one of the Transformers sequels, where you don't have a center. Everything is just spectacle, and everything is just loud, and everything is just in your face.
This movie should work. I mean, again, like in the Fast and Furious movies, they have like their character who's always doing the funny riffing. They have like all the ingredients, you know. They have their ludicrous. Like it just isn't quite funny, and the action scenes just aren't quite good. To me, I don't really like. I was glad to revisit this because I couldn't remember specifically anything I didn't like about it. And aside from like a couple moments, I still can't remember anything I don't like about it. But I don't like it. And I think for me, I mean, Dominic Senna and Simon West are obviously very similar directors in their careers, both music video people who ended up doing these action blockbusters that are often are confused. They're kind of often confused for one another. Like people often think Simon West directed Swordfish. No, Dominic Sena is the one who did California. Simon West is the one who did the Rick Rolling video. And you know, so like you kind of can keep them apart if you really struggle to try, but it is confusing. And I think it is, but like at the time, I think I was kind of, like you were saying, kind of just like annoyed by the what felt like the Bruckheimer House style. But it has aged incredibly well, these movies where every shot looks amazing. All the actors look amazing. Nicolas Cage looks incredible. Angelina Jolie looks incredible. Like they're both like looking about as good as they've ever looked. Like everyone is lit perfectly. Everyone always has sparks flying behind them or something exploding behind them. But then when it comes time for the actual heist scenes and the actual action scenes, they're surprisingly unmemorable. Yeah. And I think that's kind of an issue that I might have with Swordfish as well. Which is a movie that I'm not a big fan of, but I like things about it. But it also is another film where like the actual action doesn't really make any impression on me.
Yeah. There's also one of those sort of last films where Nicolas Cage looks really cool and handsome. And I feel like kind of what happened after this was his hair started to recede and then the chin stays again.
He's still a dapper gentleman.
Oh no, he's a good looking man. I think just part of it is because we started in 1981. It's just at like Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
Level.
We saw him like hot young Nick Cage. Like,
I mean, my Valley Girl, my God, he's like incendiary how hot and sexy he is here. And he's still, I feel like with him, a lot of times there's the Elvis level, and I felt like for Wild at Heart the Elvis level was at 10. He's like, I'm just doing Elvis, and the Elvis level here is about 5. So he's got it. He's like, we're gonna go, and we're gonna do. Mm-hmm. And there's just these moments like he has like this little monologue where he talks about, I got into it for the cars. You know, I was just in love with these. And it's ridiculous, but he's able to sell it because he has this sweetness and this sincerity. And then also he'll forever be associated with cars.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this his first big like muscle car movie?
I think so.
Because he would go on to do like Drive Angry and a bunch of other stuff. And I'm trying to remember if we had any like major Nick Cage in a muscle car movies. And now to the point where like he's so associated with that like in Willy's Wonderland, they just gave Nick Cage a muscle car just because he seems like the kind of guy who would have a muscle car.
They sure did.
Yeah.
I mean, look, one thing I've always been fascinated by with Nicolas Cage is, you know, he feels like an actor who, if you give him an interesting character, he's going to do, you know, the world's most incredible work. But if you don't, like, you know, he sometimes, I think, struggles to play just these generic action heroes in a way that maybe like a more, you know, kind of an inherently star-like, charisma-driven actor like Tom Cruise or Will Smith like might not be, because they just be like, oh, I'm supposed to just make this character myself and be fun with it. And you know, Nicolas Cage doesn't have that approach. He kind of has to come up with like a thing to do or an angle, I feel like, on the character, you know, to really explore. And I remember Gone in 60 Seconds particularly as being kind of a boring Cage performance, but actually I was wrong. It's good. And he does elevate this film. Yeah. And he has a lot of really great readings in this movie that like, it just like, I didn't quite appreciate it at the time because I always wanted him to be doing Vampire's Kiss or Raising Arizona back like during this era of cinema. But like, you know, and ultimately he only delivered one Bringing Out the Dead for me there. But watching him play these kind of stalwart, cooler than cool action heroes is still more enjoyable than watching anyone else play them, really. Because he is like making moment by moment choices that are great. And the director and editor are just like, and you wonder, like, I hope to one day find out, ideally very soon. You wonder what it is like in the editing room going through Nicolas Cage takes. It's just like, like, do you just pick like the option that makes you like stagger outside and vomit from laughing? Or do you like try to like find the consistent character in, you know, in the performance, you know?
Release the Memphis Reigns cut.
I don't know, you know, but he's such a brilliant actor and such a talented guy that he really does elevate material like this in a way that I didn't remember. Yeah,
I agree. I think the problem is that he's so deluded by the vast cast around him that it has to make so much room for like Vinnie Jones and Scott Kahn and everything, the kid from Independence Day to have a scene.
I forgot. I just remembered what I was going to say, where I was going with all that. So like both General's Daughter and Gone in 60 Seconds are movies that inexplicably make the choice to make every shot look as expensive and glossy as possible. But in Gone in 60 Seconds, that's much less jarring. So, like, you know, Travolta's charm comes across in General's Daughter. He's a likable protagonist, but it's just not a movie that's trying to be very likable in the story that it's telling. He's kind of, again, at odds with the film, whereas Nicolas Cage is perfectly in tune with whatever Gone in 60 Seconds is doing. It just wants to be fun. It just wants to entertain you. It wants to probably not be as vividly remembered as we're remembering it now, and it is quickly leaving my brain. Although, yeah, I mean, I'd completely forgotten that Timothy Olyphant and Delroy Lindo are the most enjoyable parts of this film, which they are. Like, you're absolutely
right. Yeah, and Oliphant's character's name is Detective Drycough.
Yeah, I saw that.
I love that they cast Grace Zabriskie.
Francis Fisher's there too. Yeah,
everyone involved collecting a well-earned paycheck and hopefully a nice experience making a movie where it looks like every single shot in the film took about 6 hours to set up.
Right, baby Michael Pena too.
Yeah, God, it's insane how many people are.
It is a Rosetta Stone for a lot of like kind of modern, cool, like action thriller actors. But again, I will be honest on this podcast. And treat it not as a safe space and say that I don't particularly like this one very much either. Still, I just, you watch it and you're kind of like, you know, this is great, but where are the car chases? You know, I mean, love it. I love everything they're doing. I love the way they fetishistically film the vehicles and every actor. But there's just not enough of a story, you know, and there's not enough action to really make this a memorable one for me. This is a movie that should have nonstop car chases. It's called Gone in 60 Seconds.
That is true. Yeah, if William Friedkin been the director of it, that would have been pretty
like
awesome.
Frankenheimer or somebody.
I mean, I'd settle for like a Furious 8 level of like, but you just want that. Like you want the big set pieces, you know, and it really feels like they spent so much money just making every shot in this movie look great that they like forgot to do the big action stuff.
It is interesting to me that both the National Treasure and Fast and the Furious movies, they're like, we need some heavy hitter for our sequels. Helen Mirren. Yeah. So Helen Mirren is in both the National Treasure sequel and the last two Fast and the Furious movies. And I think part of I appreciated this more because it's so 2000 and I have so much affection for that era. And I think there was kind of this time in pop culture right before September 11th where we were almost glorying in how stupid our culture could be and how shallow and how superficial. We're like, we dare you, terrorists. Yeah. We dare you to you know, give us something. And I kind of enjoyed how silly and how ridiculous and how painfully enjoyably 2000 this movie is, right up to the ridiculous electronic score by Trevor Rabin.
Yeah, and I mean the countdown clocks are in that like Spider-Man font, that really aggressive like, and like swooping in from the sides. Yeah, I mean there is a maximalism here that I do appreciate. I just wish that Gone in 60 Seconds moved a little faster. Ironically,
There we go.
There you go. That's the button. also, on a side note, I feel so poor. Christopher Eccleston like had such a hard time in Hollywood, and like he's fun. Yeah. He's fun enough as Caletri. Like he's doing his job, but I know in like interviews after, like, you know, talking about like his post Doctor Who days, especially he's like his times trying to break out in Hollywood were like really, really rough. Like between this and like the G.I. Joe movie, I was like, man, I just want good things for that man. And I'm sad that Gone in 60 Seconds wasn't one of them, even though he is, I do enjoy him in that.
But did you not see the scene where he gets beaten up with his own furniture? Come on, man.
Yeah, that is pretty great.
Storytelling.
That is an interesting wrinkle to that final scene that I do appreciate. I do enjoy that. And also, much like the Fast and Furious movies, this movie ends with the family having a barbecue.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. The ending of this film feels so much like a Fast and the Furious movie. It's like shocking. It really is one of those action movies that just thinks we want it to end with them all having a barbecue and reaffirming their affection for one another, which we often do. But in this film, I don't care. I don't mind it, you know.
Yeah. Well, just wait for the sequel where, in classic Fast and Furious fashion, Christopher Eccleston comes back from the dead and joins the family to take down another villain who will then join the family in the following movie.
I wonder if there will be another Gone in 60 Seconds. It's a good title. I wonder if it will be Italian Job where they just kind of keep making them and they always do okay. Yeah. And like, you know, maybe they just kind of keep doing it every 20 years or so.
I wonder. I think they would have, much like the Fast and Furious franchise, they would have to turn it into something else, because that franchise grew exponentially better once they decided they weren't car movies anymore. They were action movies with cars in them.
Yeah, when Justin Lin took over and just had a vision for it, you know, and I think that can sometimes be like a fascinating thing, because until then it was kind of foundering. But I, you know, there's no market for Gone in 70 Seconds.
No, not at all.
I don't think people. It's been forgotten.
Or you could go Highlander, The Quickening direction, and have the sequel take place in outer space.
There you go. Well, it looks like Fast 9 might put the cars in space. That's what the trailer seems to imply. We might be going to space, and I'm very, very happy about that.
I would assume. I would assume we're going to space. I mean,
we have to. This is a creaky joke at this point, but I swear to God, if the next film isn't Fast 10, your seatbelts, we riot at dawn. So I think that pretty much segues us into the final segment of this podcast, which is the cage match, where we determine by whatever subjective measure we have, which of these two films is quote unquote better, which might be a little more difficult this time around. Nathan, what do you think?
This is an easy one for me because I really enjoyed Gone in 60 Seconds. I found The General's Daughter distasteful. So I'm going to go with Gone in 60 Seconds because I've discovered that I like Jerry Bruckheimer movies when Nicolas Cage is a star.
Simon, what about you?
I'm going to have to go with The General's Daughter, because even though it is misguided and I think, you know, potentially offensive, it's at least, I think, trying to do something good and interesting not a lot of films do. Whereas Gone in 60 Seconds just to me feels like the template for something that people got right a few years later when they made it much more like multicultural and just like international and like its fan scope, and they just like kind of figured out a better way to tell like a silly story of that exact nature. You know, not to say that like, you know, I obviously think there are better like car heist films, you know, out there in the world than the Fast and Furious sequels, but it just feels so like something that there's so many other versions of, and this just happens to be a fairly like, you know, middle of the road one. Whereas General's Daughter is trying for something fairly bold, I think, and I give it points because I just genuinely think like there is something interesting there in its ideas. It just like the director didn't quite, I think, have the right maybe approach to the material. Though again, I am sympathetic because I think he was just like, I'll make this look good and entertaining, and maybe no one will be mad at me. and they weren't. It was a huge success, you know. And so I think I find The General's Daughter to be a more interesting movie, and now that I, and like with reflection, it feels more like an anomaly, this expensive, flashy, glossy, depressing movie about the institution of rape in the US military. It's just a weird, unique film that I think has something to say, says it badly and possibly troublingly, but that still kind of puts it a little ahead of Gone in 60 Seconds in my book.
Yeah, it's so tough. It's so weird being the tiebreaker for this, because I think there are pros and cons for both. Because it feels weird putting General's Daughter, which, you know, on its surface, again, feels like that kind of trite airport thriller thing that was very popular in the 90s. But like you also, like you said, we don't get that many movies like that anymore. And also, for as much flash and unabashed stupidity as Gone in 60 Seconds gives us, I don't know if it really elevates itself beyond its own mimetic nature as a Nick Cage car movie that is mostly remembered with that gif of Nick Cage doing the okay, let's go to Lowrider. So I think almost begrudgingly, I may have to give it to General's Daughter. Also because I feel greatly sympathetic for Travolta over the course of this podcast, because he's gotten so few wins. Yeah. And I just want to give him the win.
But you've reminded me that they get psyched up to steal cars by listening to Lowrider.
Yeah, and then what happens for the rest of the hour?
One of the many incredibly cheesy things they did that I enjoyed tremendously, even though objectively they're incredibly stupid.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I think if I have to put my foot down, I'm going to give Travolta the long overdue win and give it to General's Daughter. We will always have that gif of Nick Cage jamming out to Lowrider.
He stole this podcast.
Congratulations, General's Daughter, for being an ambitious but misguided artifact of a genre of film that we do not see much anymore. Congratulations to Timothy Hutton for getting blown up by a landmine.
but he commits suicide. In a weirdly unsatisfying denouement. But it's interesting to revisit both these films. I mean, I guess they're both, Nathan, what you used to call forgotbusters. These movies that made a huge impression at the time, but then like no lasting impression culturally. But then you look back and they were both in like the top 10 movies of the year. And like, they're these weird movies. I always think of the film SWAT as just like a film that everyone I know has kind of seen it, but no one I know like really necessarily remembers that it exists.
You know what I remember about SWAT is Jeremy Renner. That was Dahmer, and then he was the bad guy in SWAT. I'm like, who is this guy? And will I be impressed by him for 15 years? And then completely over him.
No. The thing I remember about SWAT is tied to Jeremy Renner as well. When Jeremy Renner was up for the Oscar for The Hurt Locker, I remember when they were announcing the Best Actor category, they would have colleagues of each nominee come up and talk about their experience working with that actor. And because Jeremy Renner was Jeremy Renner at the time, this was a big break for him as like a big actor, an A-lister. Their person for him was Colin Farrell coming up and talking about working with him on SWAT, which I felt was a really weird experience compared to everyone else talking about their acclaimed careers on this stage at the Academy Awards. It'd be like having whoever he co-starred with in that National Lampoon movie go up and talk to him at the Oscar Valley. Man, I remember him being really nice on set on that party bus.
They're oddly like kind of interestingly similar stars to me. That kind of makes sense. Like Colin Farrell and Jeremy Renner, and that they like are really fascinating again in kind of character performances, but occasionally, you know, will just play the lead in something and kind of disappear into the material. Like they both are I find that fascinating about both of them.
But Colin Farrell does not have a failed app branded to himself. So there's one point in his favor.
Well, or in Jeremy Renner's favor, depending. I mean, like I would say in Bruges is in the Colin Farrell column, but the app is in the Jeremy Renner column.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. All right. Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage. Simon, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was an absolute blast.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Of course, of course. And I can't wait to see the Face-Off sequel, Knock Wood. Let's hope it happens. Yay. And I can't wait to see it soon. Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
No, I have I don't know when this comes out, but I directed a supernatural murder mystery called Seance that comes out May 21st in limited theaters and on VOD. I would, of course, be remiss in not urging any citizen who has not yet done so to see Godzilla versus Kong. Legally compelled to see it in theaters. So we'll plug both of those for now if you don't mind. But other than that, we will try to do the honorable thing with our Face-Off sequel and make it the best movie ever made.
Absolutely. I cannot wait to see it. Well, again, thanks so much for listening to Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Wherever that is, please rate and review us. It helps us out a lot. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Travolta Cage. I'm on Twitter at Clint Worthing. Nathan's on Twitter at Nathan Rabin. Simon, what's your Twitter handle?
Simon_Barrett.
Excellent. You can send us messages you can send us emails at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. Please support the podcast if you like us and you want to support us. You can go to patreon.com/TravoltaCage. You'll get exclusive episodes and you'll help us keep the lights on. Thanks so much for listening. And now, if you'll excuse me, I gotta poo.